Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today are personal finance writer Kate Bearley and special guests David Reed, co-manager of BlackRock Emerging Europe Investment Trust, Adrian Lowcock, head of investing at AXA Self Investor, and Jason Whitcomb, certified financial planner and director at Evolve. Today, we're discussing whether you should move your portfolio into safer assets in the run-up to retirement. Traditionally, investors used to move their pension savings into safer assets as retirement approached to preserve any gains with the purchase of an annuity in mind. But in April, the retirement landscape was radically changed when new rules came into force, allowing savers much more freedom on what they do with their retirement pots. Adrian, under what circumstances would it still be appropriate to de-risk your pension pot in the run-up to retirement?
I think for a lot of people, you're still going to have to do some sort of de-risking, no matter who you are, unless you've got a substantial sum of money and you're well ahead of your objectives for retirement. But if you're close to your objectives or perhaps a little bit behind your objectives and you're getting to that point of retirement, you're going to need to protect what capital you've got. So it's basically about how much money and how far you are closer to your objectives to actually determine how much risk you should be taking on. So de-risking is quite essential getting closer to retirement, but with the sort of flexibility now, you need to sort of make sure you combine some lower level of risk with outlooks to have some flexibility in investments and savings.
Jason, what's your position on this?
Yeah, I think it's become very difficult because in the past, when there was this obligation to buy an annuity, you could plan towards that and you know, at the end of the day, you had to buy an annuity at 75 historically. But now, people have got so many different objectives with their retirement pots, their pension pots, because of this flexibility. So partly it's about producing an income in retirement. But then there's also the ability to pass money on to kids and grandkids in a tax efficient way. And it's trying to weigh up all of those objectives to then do that first and then look back at how, you know, how your investments need to be spread to meet with those objectives. And I think it's becoming increasingly difficult to try to get a strategy that allows you to do all of those things at the same time.
What sort of strategies could you pursue, though?
We try to take quite a simplistic approach to investment, take a sort of a whiskey and water type approach. So traditionally, equities as the whiskey, water it down with something low risk. So short-dated bonds would be an area that we use, but others will take a different approach. But, you know, it sort of depends on when you're going to need the money. So one, take an example. Annuities seem to have got a bad name for themselves, but as part of someone's retirement income strategy, they might take the view that they take a proportion of their pension fund out, buy an annuity with that, and at least they know where they stand with a bit of their money. And then with the balance, maybe they can afford to take a bit more investment risk because at least there's a sort of a bedrock of retirement income, add the state pension to that as well, that at least covers the bills. So, you know, a bit of annuity purchase maybe, and then, you know, to make things like all this flexibility around drawdown work, you need to be taking a reasonable amount of risk. Otherwise, you're not likely to get the same sort of income you could have got through an annuity.
Adrian, what kind of strategy would you pursue?
I think I like to look at this retirement planning in sort of a bucket approach. So basically, you've got four risks in retirement. You have longevity, how long you're going to live in retirement. None of us really know, but we tend to underestimate how long we're going to live. You have inflation risk, so money gets eroded by inflation. You have volatility of investments, and you have flexibility. Not any single thing or asset will address all four of those issues. So you need a bucket, different buckets to address the different risks. So I think having, as Jason said, a small amount in an annuity, that can sort of give you that certainty. It can give you a sum of money that will exist no matter how long you live. And it pays for the necessities in life, the food and the heating bills. And then you can have other pots of money, so perhaps a bit of cash that will sort of give you your daily income, your annual income, that effectively means that you don't have to worry about the volatility of stock markets. And then the inflation and flexibility, that can be addressed by various types of investments, and that could be your higher risk area. Now, depending on your attitude to risk, depends on what sort of how much you have in each bucket, if you like, and what you may have in the individual buckets as well. So you may be a very cautious person. You may have a little bit less in higher risk equities in the final bucket, and a more adventurous person may have more in that overall area and less in cash. But by doing that, you have a sort of framework from which to build your retirement.
You're talking about the framework, drilling down to the investments. What kind of investments would you use to fill out this framework?
Yeah, so the first one, annuities, I mean, that's just a simple product that you would buy, get a good rate. You might consider an inflation-adjusted one so that you can protect against capital. The cash bucket, that's just effective, basically a cash savings, get a good cash account. And then with investments, you're really looking, I think, in this climate, bonds, they don't particularly offer attractive yields, certainly wouldn't look at government debt at the moment, but you can get a reasonable yield on some bonds. You can particularly use products that might be quite useful, that could be quite strategic in this climate. And then it's, you know, I think it's going to still be largely equities in this climate. Get a diversified portfolio, so get UK equity income, global income, but also perhaps something like a diversified real assets fund that gives access to infrastructure and products like that, so that you get a broad range of income. And then within that, you may still want to have some growth, because you want that pot of money to grow. And ideally, you can then take a natural income from it, as opposed to drawing down on the capital, which would sort of impact on your longevity question. So it's getting a broad range of assets, but equities look like the sort of prime place to be at the moment, because you can grow that income still.
Jason, would you focus on equities, or how would you asset allocate?
For us, it comes back to this sort of whiskey and water approach, a very broad, diversified portfolio of equity funds, UK and overseas, bit of a tilt towards small companies and value companies and emerging markets, which you would hope in the long run to get a sort of an extra premium for investing in those. But we take the view that the lower risk bit has to be in short-dated bonds for us. And it's a difficult market. You know, they're not paying much in the way of yield. But from our perspective, what else do you do to diversify away from equities? You know, our hope would be that if economic conditions go against bonds, hopefully those economic conditions will favour equities in the long run. And it's sort of a balanced approach. But you know, my real concern is that there are a lot of people out there with their pension pot at the point of retirement who really don't have enough money. And there's this issue of capacity for loss. You know, a lot of people can't afford to lose much money with their pensions. And you know, there is a danger that people say, well, I don't like the story about bonds at the moment, and end up having a bit too much in equities. Suddenly we have a stock market crash that they can never recover from, because they're drawing an income as well. So I think there's an element of overconfidence that people have in, you know, how long this money is going to last. And for some people, however unattractive annuity rates might look, at least it gives you a guarantee for some part of your retirement income.
Adrian, are there any traps that you would highlight?
I think, as Jason mentioned, the longevity issue is significant, and we really should prepare to live longer than we perhaps expect. But I think the biggest trap is going to be inflation. We don't have it particularly at the moment. It's very low, almost non-existent. But who's to say that won't return in 5 years, and what it will be like in 20 or 30 years' time? And if you're retiring at 65 at the moment, you know, life expectancies are going out. It's not unrealistic to expect to live 20 or 30 years in retirement, during which time inflation can easily halve the value of money. 3% inflation will halve the value of money in about 23 years. That is significant. So that's the big trap to avoid.
Okay. We count a number of emerging markets funds among our IC Top 100 funds, and these include BlackRock Emerging Europe. In this region, Russia in particular has hit the headlines over the past 18 months following its annexation of Crimea. David, countries including the UK have imposed sanctions on Russia. Does this affect your existing investments? Will you have to sell any? And will it adversely affect your choice of potential investments going forward?
Thank you for the question. So sanctions have been a very significant issue for Russia over the past year. But I think what made them particularly painful for the country was the combination of sanctions and falling oil prices. Those two factors, whether it was oil tax receipts or external borrowing, were the two main sources of foreign currency financing for the country. And so they've been in a very tight spot liquidity-wise. And that intensified into December in in particular. And there was one particular day, in fact, where the ruble moved 30% intraday. Now, our positioning going into the second half of last year was actually very underweight Russia. We realized after the very unfortunate MH17 plane disaster that sanctions were a realistic possibility. And of course, the oil price ended up compounding those. So in terms of relative performance, it was something we were actually well prepared for. But when we saw that capitulation event in December, we actually started to increase our positions. And we're now in a position where we're overweight Russia. We think there's a massive amount of value there in the market. I think what people often forget is that a lot of the companies in Russia, despite the economic situation, are actually doing reasonably well. A good example would be the oil companies, which are the largest part of the index. Yes, the oil price has fallen, but we shouldn't forget that their costs are in rubles, and the ruble has depreciated even more than the oil price fell. And so that means their profitability is still very strong. They are internationally exceptionally competitive, and these companies are trading on price-to-earnings ratios of just 5 times and quite comfortably paying out sustainable 7% dividend yields. So it's a good opportunity for the long-term investor. And one of the nice things about the investment trust structure is that we can look through periods of turbulence like this, take our opportunities and maximise returns over the long term.
And in fact, your top stock is now Sberbank, isn't it? Which obviously is Russian stock. And has that been the one that you've been adding to particularly, and what and why that one?
So Sberbank's a very interesting case. It's the stock which is typically the bellwether stock for sentiment on the ruble. And the ruble is a very oil-linked currency. And so when the ruble was selling off in the fourth quarter of last year, Sberbank shares were beaten down to exceptionally cheap levels. This is one of the most profitable banks in the world. It's not showing it at the moment because Russia is going through a difficult time economically speaking, and some of the debt that they have outstanding is not performing. But the underlying profitability is such that even despite this, they're still likely to make a profit this year, and this is in a recessionary year. Whereas normally you'd be expecting them to generate a return on equity of north of 15%, and that's actually a very, very high rate, particularly in a world that's starved for yield.
So what's your plan with that stock? Are you holding it at the same level, or do you think you'll be increasing the allocation, reducing it?
Well, you know, I think like a lot of Russian companies that we hold, we are intending to hold them for the long term. They have certain characteristics that we think are very advantageous. I think it's probably worth remarking on the sort of change of mandate or investment strategy that we had with the trust about 18 months ago, where we moved the trust to a focused and unconstrained strategy. So we have a maximum number of holdings, up to 30 holdings. So we're really picking the stocks that we think have the best value opportunity, have the best potential cash flow generation going forward, and Sberbank is one of those stocks.
And that was quite a reduction, wasn't it, on the number of stocks you were holding before?
Yes, it was. We inherited this trust from the previous manager back in 2009. We ran it fairly successfully from that period up until the continuation vote. But the board at that stage essentially came to us and said, if you were going back and with a blank piece of paper to make the right investment strategy for the region, how would you do it? And this was the main change that we made. A good example of what it means in practice, if you look at the emerging European benchmark, it's very dominated by the three traditional sectors, if you like, of energy, financials and materials. Those are typically very large companies, state-owned, and not always representative of the best opportunities in the region. Moving away from a benchmark-constrained process meant that we were in a better position to take opportunities in the technology sector, for instance, which has, you know, it's a very promising area. There's a lot of Russians and Eastern Europeans more generally who are doing fantastic things in the technology space. And, you know, that is a sector which is not represented at all in the benchmark. The same is true of healthcare, for instance, which is also a very interesting space for us. And so really, we wanted to move away from the inherent biases in the benchmark and really concentrate on what we thought would be the best opportunities over the life of the trust.
And I'm talking about the benchmark and about this kind of concentration of stocks. We should mention performance. I mean, this clearly isn't a fund which gives you kind of a smooth ride, obviously. So returns have been pretty up and down, as has your performance against the benchmark. I mean, how pleased have you been with returns over the past few years?
Well, you know, the region in absolute terms has had a difficult few years. I think what we are pleased about is our relative performance. We released our monthly update yesterday, and over the past 3 years, we've outperformed the benchmark by roughly 12%. And we've done that precisely by not following the crowd, by having the conviction to go with the opportunities which we thought were most interesting.
And we've talked about Russia, but we should obviously talk about Greece. You now have a relatively large holding in National Bank of Greece, which is a new holding for you, isn't it, since last year. Can you talk to us about why you hold that, and also what you think about the potential of a Greek exit?
Sure. Well, it's a huge topic. We could probably do a half-hour show on that alone. But perhaps a little bit of history may be useful context. Greece used to be an emerging market stock, a country rather, many years ago. It re-entered our benchmark in 2012, quite controversially. And we actually held zero Greece in the trust from that period until last year. At the time, we thought that earnings expectations were unrealistic and the valuations were too high. And it was a very fashionable market. People were pitching the Greek recovery story. Obviously, in stock market terms, that didn't transpire. And as the market started to fall prior to the elections at the beginning of this year, that was the first time that we'd started to accumulate Greek positions once valuations had gotten down to levels we felt reflected the risks involved. And as we've gone through the turbulence so far this year, we've actually slowly moved into a slightly overweight position. It's, you know, I want to be very clear, it's not a huge proportion of our trust. Risk management is a very important part of what we do at BlackRock. And we make sure that all the exposures we take are first of all very deliberate, but also appropriately diversified and appropriately scaled. But we are optimistic on Greece. And the logic behind that is really twofold. The first thing is that if you look at polling in Greece, there is very consistent popular support for staying in the euro. It polls at about 70 to 75%. And even if you ask people whether they would accept a deal to stay in the euro with tough conditions, that still has majority support of about 55%. And so striking an agreement at some stage would be a popular thing to do domestically. The second thing is that the gap between Greece and the creditors has actually narrowed quite a lot. We know that it's roughly about 0.5% of GDP in terms of public spending 2 years out. That is not a huge sum in the scale of things. A Grexit-type scenario would certainly cost the public spending in Greece a lot more than half a percentage point of GDP. And similarly for Europe, it's not a particularly large price to pay. So both popularity and economic logic, and even social welfare for that matter, would point towards an agreement. However, you do obviously have to understand that there are risks involved here. There's a lot of politics, and so you can never say it's a sure thing. But we have been here once before in Greece when the previous bailout package was being negotiated, and we just have to hope that they eventually take a similar course this time around.
Okay, well, I think that's probably all we've got time for on that, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today is the anniversary of the alternative investment market, commonly referred to as AIM. This market has performed badly over the years, but some of the funds which invest in it have done really well. So Adrian, should investors consider funds which invest in AIM?
Yeah, I think AIM is a market that you shouldn't look at the index. It's a stock picker's market. So if you're looking at AIM, you've really got to look at individual shares, and it's all about stock selection. But having said that, there are some exceptional companies in there, and it's really about trying to find those companies that can double, treble, or even rise tenfold to make returns. But it is very, very risky.
What sort of risks would investors face in a fund with, let's say, substantial AIM exposure?
Well, the key thing is companies that list on AIM don't go through quite the same regulatory controls that they do to go onto the main London Stock Exchange. So you do have sort of governance risks and corporate issues that may crop up. It's in a market that also attracts startups for this reason, because they don't have the costs of having to sort of fulfill the requirements of a main listing. It attracts companies that are perhaps at a startup phase or fledgling stage. And these companies, by their nature, you know, for every one that is a success, there's probably another 10 or so that don't you never hear about. And that's the nature of startup businesses. Most of them don't make it, and even those that do survive don't necessarily grow. So that's another key risk. One of the ways to address these types of risks is to ensure you're well diversified across AIM, because all the fund managers I meet and talk to, they don't get it right 100% of the time. So they diversify their portfolios to make sure that no one individual company takes huge amounts of portfolio and they have to fight another day.
Yes. If an investor can take these risks, what sort of role could an AIM fund play in your portfolio?
Well, it usually will sort of feature in a smaller part of a smaller company's fund or part of your smaller company's exposure in the UK. It does have about a portion of the AIM market is actually invested in international companies, so it's not just a UK exposure. But you're looking at basically UK smaller companies, growth factor. It could really add that sort of little bit of sort of growth that can feature in a portfolio. So it's the high risk growth side of your portfolio. Long-term investing, usually people say at least 5 years. I always think you should be investing at least 10 years. And I think with AIM, you've got to look through that and beyond.
Turning to passive funds, recent research shows that some tracker funds have lagged their benchmark index by more than 4%. Kate, specifically, what does the report say and why have these trackers been underperforming their indices?
We have been looking into the performance of some tracker funds, and it's in relation to a report that Chelsea Financial Services has produced, which is its most recent list of worst performing funds. So they name the kind of worst performing funds over the last three discrete years, taken from a list of funds which produce third or fourth quartile returns every year. So this year there were 20 tracker funds in the list from the UK oil companies sector, and five of those had underperformed their benchmarks by more than 4% in 3 years. One actually underperformed by 9%. So I thought I'd have a look at which these were and why that might be. Obviously, the thing about trackers is you do want them to track efficiently, so this does look like quite poor performance. Usually, if a tracker's underperforming, it's either because it's very expensive, because the fees are distracting from the returns, or because it has a high tracking error due to the kind of poor use of derivatives or something similar. Now, it turns out in most of the cases of these funds which were underperforming, so had a few Legal & General and the family charities Ethical, which was the worst performer, lagging by 9%. Most of these were legacy funds with a very expensive share class. And so I think that was kind of the lesson here, that in fact, most of these funds had newer, more updated share classes, which were cheaper and which tracked better. I had a chat with Legal & General about it, who said that one of the funds in this list was actually under review and the others were legacy structures, which you wouldn't necessarily buy as an investor going in for the first time.
Jason, have you been using tracker funds for your clients, and will you change this in light of these findings?
Yeah, I mean, we were very early adopters of tracker funds. So we started using tracker funds with our clients when we founded the business around 10 years ago. And we think they're fantastic. We'll carry on using them. We don't use any of the tracker funds that have been on this list that you were just talking about. The thing with tracker funds is you expect them to track their index, and one of the key ways they can do that is to be very low cost. So cost is one of the key differentiating factors between tracker funds and active funds. And if you've got an expensive tracker fund, you're in a bad fund probably. So when we look at the combination of costs of the portfolios that our clients have, they're looking at about 0.3% per annum. So very low cost, whereas there are tracker funds out there that charge 1% per annum. It's probably funds that charge more. And it's just a bad thing. You just don't want to be paying that much to track an index.
Yeah, I mean, we should say that some of these funds were charging kind of 1.5% ongoing charge, which is, kind of an active management fee, isn't it? And I think that was the problem here.
Adrian, do you think tracker funds have a place in people's portfolios?
I think I'm very much of the view that basically there's a place for everything in a portfolio and everything has its place. I think with tracker funds, they're really suited for markets where it's hard to get an active manager that can add value. So the US has been a tipped as that in recent years. And also they can be very effective, particularly after markets had a big sell-off. So following the financial crisis, a lot of active managers missed out on what was deemed the dash for trash rally, because active managers don't want to be buying trash, but a tracker fund will hold everything, and therefore it rallies with the market. However, at the current point, I think with markets looking on the top end of fair value and possibly expensive in parts, you increasingly end up buying the expensive areas with a tracker fund along with the smaller cheap areas. But as the areas that are cheap become fewer, you end up having more of your money in the expensive areas. So actually, I think active manager becomes a more interesting area at this point in time.
Okay. Another trend in the passive world has been the rise in popularity of exchange-traded funds, known as ETFs, which are hedged to sterling, partly because of the increased volatility in the currency markets. Kate, have these currency-hedged ETFs actually improved investors' returns?
The short answer is yes, they have in some cases. I had a look at whether they've improved returns, but also what impact they've had in terms of volatility. So QE, as you said, has been the real argument for currency hedging because it's had such an impact on devaluing currencies, particularly in Japan and Europe. So it's been a really good thing to take out that risk of converting your weak currency back to sterling, which is stronger, and then taking a big hit on returns. So when you look at the European and Japanese indices, it's very clear that the hedged version over the past year have outperformed. And we see that as well with the ETFs. There's a very popular European one which comes up a lot, the UBS, it's the MSCI EMU 100% hedged to GBP. And that outperformed over a year by 10%, the same ETF, which is unhedged. And the same is true of Japan. Every ETF I looked at, the hedged version had outperformed. So certainly in the past year, you would definitely have been better off with a hedged ETF. Volatility is a less clear argument, actually, because these hedged indices and hedged ETFs aren't less volatile when it comes to equities. But actually, when you look at fixed income, they are much less volatile. So in fact, the answer seems to be, in terms of performance, yes, hedging has improved performance, certainly in Japan and Europe, but you haven't had a smoother ride when it comes to equities.
Jason, do you use currency hedged ETFs of your clients?
We don't specifically use ETFs, but we do use a currency hedged bond fund with our clients. So I think the thing to remember with currency is it's a zero-sum game. So some currencies will go up, others will go down, but you're not going to necessarily make money out of currency unless you're speculating and get lucky. So for most of our clients, sterling is the most important currency. And for their equity funds, we've taken the view that we're not going to use hedged funds because, you know, sometimes you'll win, sometimes you'll lose because of this zero-sum game argument. But with the bond part of our clients' exposure, you know, they want a low volatility fund. That's the role of the bond fund within our portfolios, at least, and therefore we feel it has to be hedged back to sterling.
Adrian, do you think investors should opt for funds which hedge against currency movements?
I think Jason's absolutely right. It's a zero-sum game and effectively very difficult to predict. So if you're going to hedge against currency, it's really about minimising risks and reducing volatility in a portfolio, particularly in the equity market. If you speak to fund managers in that space, majority of them don't get involved in currency. So they take a polar view. Either they don't hedge it or they do, or actually more increasingly, they just offer investors with the choice that they make. So on the whole, I don't look to sort of get involved in the currency debate and tend not to actually hedge. It's very, very difficult to make money in hedging, and you can protect a portfolio in the short term, but you could easily lose that protection in the longer term if you get your call wrong.
And I think it has been over the past year. It was a clearer call, wasn't it, with QE devaluing the yen and the euro. But in recent months, that has become less clear. And after that has played out, it definitely won't be such a clear argument. And since the beginning of the year, even the yen has been kind of moving sideways a bit. So,
I mean, the yen and the Japan has always been the obvious argument about currency hedging, but it isn't an absolute that the yen falls and the stock market rises. It's only been true, okay, for the last 30 years, but before that, there wasn't as much correlation, and we could see that reverse at some point in the future. The correlation between the yen and the stock market rising may not exist in the future, so it's not an absolute.
Okay, some things to think about there before you opt for hedging. Thank you very much to our special guests, Adrian Locock, Head of Investing at Axis Self Investor, Jason Whitcomb, Certified Financial Planner and Director at Evolve, and David Reed, Co-Manager of BlackRock Emerging Europe. Thanks also to personal finance writer Kate Bealey. You can read more about moving your pension into safer assets, AIM and tracker fund performance in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle. Thank you for listening and have a great weekend.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.